Hello and welcome to the Blindside edition of the Whiteboard Rugby podcast. And as on Thursday, I am joined by Lockie Clark, World Cup winner. Lockie, how are you?
Hello. Yes, I'm wonderful. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we are going to talk in this episode about you, basically. We spoke about the Women's World Cup on Thursday, but we're going to talk about your career. So your career spans such a length of time, Lockie, which I know is a kind of, there's no easy way of saying that, even being around as a professional player, though as a high level player for such a long period of time. When you look back at that journey, where do you see rugby back then, and what's the biggest difference to how it is now? Obviously professionalism and things like that, but is there kind of a more fundamental thing that's changed?
Yeah, so one of the things, you look back at a team photo, I got my first cap in 2003. You look at the photo and you could go, right, they're a prop, they're a winger, they're this, they're that, they're number eight, etc. You look at a team photo now and it is quite different to the, you know, they're a bit rounded in 2003, but they're just pure athletes now. And yeah, a few players you can tell what position they play, but certainly, you know, maybe between numbers 4 and 12, it's quite hard to see who's what. But yeah, I'd say the biggest factor obviously helps with professionalism, being able to recover and train full time is a massive difference. But also the physicality of the game. You know, I look at sevens now and the breakdown, I think, Christ, I would not like to be in that. They are brutal. You know, the speed at which they're running into that and just no, you know, F's given. They just get into the ruck, smash it over and boom, ball's gone. So, yeah, that has evolved as well as the sort of tactical awareness, the kicking game as well. There has obviously always been the physicality, but I think the speed of players and the size of players has gone up, so the collisions are bigger. So it's a different game nowadays. It's it's brutal.
You talked there about the professionalism. So you were 22 when you got your first England cap. What does professionalism give you? I mean, it feels like a fairly basic question. You have more time, I guess, but is there other stuff that provides you?
The biggest thing is recovery. So when I were, so I had a 15-year international career and I went full-time for the last year. And the difference it made to being able to, right, I've just done a running session. I can now recover for the next 4 hours. I can go and get a massage. I can, speak to the psychologist. I can then go to rugby training in the evening and that kind of thing. So there was times 2014 I was training 3 times a day, holding down a full-time gym job, which was lucky because I could train on my breaks. And you know, some of the sessions were as short as sort of 30 to 40 minutes, but some of them, like weight sessions, were 90 plus minutes, and your rugby training maybe up to 2 hours. So yeah, you had to fit it around recovery. And then just the expertise that you're getting and the specific individual stuff, the time that you can have to have the massages, the physio, the prehab, is all different to how I certainly started when, you know, there were people who were police women and they were coming off shift and then going to camp to go into a Six Nations weekend and they hadn't had any sleep in like, you know, that's just asking for an injury. So yeah, that'd be the biggest difference.
Do you miss those times? Has it changed?
Hell yes. Yeah. Do you know what? It's really hard retiring. I don't think people are as open about it, but it was really hard. Like I said, 15 years of playing at the top level, playing with my mates week in, week out was the best time of my life. And I miss it dearly. What I love now is I can give back in coaching, being an ambassador, helping the game grow, being a commentator, doing after dinner stuff, guest speaking, so I can give back my experience of it. But it is, I miss it so much. Nothing compares to it.
Can you talk us through that moment in 2003 when you won your first cap? Was that something did you know it was coming? Did it come out of the blue?
Really, I'm laughing because it came out of the blue, and I'll be honest, it was one of the worst experiences of my life, getting my first cap when we're in Canada. It's 34 degrees heat. It's a really fast game. I spoke earlier about Canada being really fit, really physical, really fast. And I was very, very heavy when I got my first cap. I'd gone to uni, I'd enjoyed life far too much, and I was about 109 kilos. So running around 34 degrees, trying to keep up at a pace of people that I'd never played at. I thought I was going to be the first female to have a heart attack on the pitch. I was purple when I went inside, and they got me an ice towel. I thought, brilliant, they'll take me off. And they didn't. They left me on for another 10 minutes. I only touched the ball once when a line out went wrong and it bounced up in my hand, and I carried and I got absolutely walloped, and I thought, oh my god, this is welcome to international rugby. But I tell you what, that gave me the kick up the bum to change fitness from my weakness to my strength and get fit. I lost loads of weight, trained like an absolute beast, and a year later I was 80 kilos, and you know, that was the start of my longevity within the England squad. And I'd just changed my life around, and that was my number one priority. And I was so lucky to get the support then, and really proud of what I did myself to be able to do that.
Why do you think it was that you didn't play that game and go, this isn't for me, this is way too hard? Why do you think you were able to turn yourself around and get better?
Playing for England, the carrot was dangled. There's no better feeling. Absolutely no better feeling. It was, you know, I remember I was sat on a minibus and I was looking around. There's Georgia Stevens, TJ, Susie Appleby, Paula George. And I looked around and I thought, these are my absolute idols. And I'm sat on a bus with my heroines. Like, oh my God, of course I want to do it again. Yes. And I did it for 137 times in total. Not bad innings.
Do you remember the first game where it felt like you belonged there?
Yeah, it was my third cap. So I went and played in England A, lost my weight, and then got called back in for the autumn internationals, I think it was then. And it was just incredible, the difference. And I just was hungry. I didn't know who people were in terms of the opposition. So I ran as hard as I could, didn't know who I was scrummaging against. And just being fearless and physical, and people were like, this kid has done well, changed her life around, different person, but still got that same aggression, still got that same hunger. And yeah, I guess you feel like you belong there maybe 10, 15 caps in, but that was the start of it. That was like, yeah, I'm here and I'm here to stay.
Your first World Cup was 2006, again in Canada, back where you made your debut. Just can you paint a picture of what that tournament was like, what the crowd was like, what was the travel like, what was kind of the situation in 2006?
Yeah, so 2006, we were getting mini-bussed out to our training venue. We were in Edmonton, so there really wasn't very much there. We were bussed to and from the training venue. We didn't particularly have many people watching us. Big empty stadium, even for the final. The final had all different weathers throughout the day. You had some snow, sun, rain, storms. It was everything had gone through. The hotel we had was right out, sort of in a business place. There were, you know, you couldn't walk and get a coffee or anything. So really confined to the hotel. And the night before the final, there was a wedding. And you all were on this, like, I don't know what to call it, like you're on the outskirts of this round circle, and then down below was like a dance floor and things. So you were literally, you open your bedroom door and you could see people dancing and walking through, and you're like, I'm playing the biggest game of my life and I'm still wide awake at 2 a.m, can't sleep. You know, it just shows you the difference of professionalism now, that would not be a thing. And yeah, just not, you basically had a family, a few really strong, women's rugby fans, but you there wasn't that many people out there. And of course, it was horrendous losing the final. Because I thought we were going to win it. I think we lost by 8 points. And everybody knows this feeling when you've been heartbroken the first time, you're in love, you think your heart's been ripped out, and that's how it felt 10 times worse than that. You feel like your whole world has ended. It was awful. And obviously, I've been in three World Cup finals where I've lost it, and one World Cup final where I've won it. So your first loss is the worst. And yeah, you sort of learn to help others on your next one. But it's yeah, it was a really horrible time losing that final.
Was it sweeter because when you finally did win, in 2014, was it sweeter because of those? Well, I guess it was two losses at that point that you had in the finals.
Yeah, third time lucky. And as I said, 2010, I'd put my house on we'd won. We'd beaten New Zealand in the autumn. We were playing really well, really dominant. But New Zealand really did their homework on us and just disrupted our breakdown, which meant we couldn't get it to our speedsters. And they gave away yellow cards. They banked on it not being reds. And they played the perfect game to stop us playing. And yeah, that was really horrible to be that. But then obviously winning the World Cup final in 2014, my mum had come over, loads of family, the stadium was full and bouncing in Jean Boehm, Stade de Jean Boehm, and it was just bouncing. And I remember final whistle goes, and of course then it was when you only had one prop on the bench, so I played the whole game. I was nearly having a heart attack trying to run back cover. And I thought, please don't lose it, please don't lose it, please don't lose it. And I just remember sprinting back, and it was just, yeah, hit another level. But then final whistle went, I dropped to my knees, and it wasn't like sheer, amazement, brilliance, best day of my life. It was sheer relief. And then about after 30 seconds, I came round, I was like, we've effing done it, we've effing done it. And then I was hyper and ecstatic and all of that. But it was, thank God. Thank God, finally done it. So yeah, look at me talking. I'm absolutely grinning ear to ear. It's so good.
We had Izzel Dagong on a couple of weeks ago, and one of the questions we asked him was, how do you cope with the pressure? Because I mean, I've kicked in grassroots games, and even that I found a challenge. The idea of doing it on the biggest stage when you've got this World Cup final, it just feels so alien that you could ever even perform to a decent standard, let alone a standard that would bring home a World Cup.
Well, I'm somebody who's always quite relaxed and a bit bantery, a bit playful before I play. Something we did really well was sort of have our switch on time. And that was done by having your meetings, your forwards meetings, your team meetings. So when you sort of came in then, everything was really focused. On the bus traveling to the game, I'd be chatting to some mates, having a bit of a laugh. Some people had their headphones on in the zone focus, but for me to be relaxed, I had to be normal right up until we crossed the whitewash, and then I was like, boom, suddenly able to change the person I was, and I was in professional mode then. But I had a roommate, Kerry Large. She got 57 caps, and I think I shared with her 50 odd times. And we just used to muck about, have such a laugh, and be silly together. And we used to play room wars as well against other rooms to sort of take up the time on the dull evenings. So we just always have a laugh, and that was the biggest thing, be relaxed. But when it came to training, when it came to games, boom, you've got to flick that switch and be on it.
Well, you obviously broke England's cap record with 137 caps, which was then broken by Sale Hunter. I guess the way to get those is obviously be amazing for as many years as you were, but also want to keep going. Were there times where you thought, this is enough, I've kind of done this enough?
No, so I guess towards the end, I started feeling, training become a bit of a like slug. But no, I'd have probably carried on a bit longer, maybe. Oh, I don't know. It was a tough one. You look now, and I'd do anything for a cap. But It's yeah, it was tough towards the end, and I guess we all knew my time was coming. I couldn't have done another World Cup cycle. Well, I'd have argued maybe I could have, but yeah, it was getting on. I was 37 at my last cap, and I thoroughly enjoyed the highs and the lows, and overall, it was an amazing experience. And you do anything to be back in that changing room, but then that's why it's been so amazing to play Barbarians the four occasions I have, because you get that camaraderie, you get all that banter and being amongst it, and the physicality. I still love it. That's why I still play at my ripe old age of 43. So yeah, I can't get enough of it. There needs to be an England vet, and then I'd try and go for that record.
It feels a little bit like you felt last you'll maybe some additional caps were taken from you that you would have kept going were it not for external factors. Is that would that be right, or was it your choice as well to pack it in when you
It
did?
was a bit of a bit of both. I had the chat with the coaches, and I could have possibly got a few more, but they were gonna name other props within the squad, and there was obviously injuries and potentially invited to training. But what I didn't want to do was be, just get crap at rugby, and then people go, "Why is she not retired?" I wanted to retire sort of at the top of my game. I'd obviously peaked, and I was still at a high level, but I was sort of moved towards a finisher, and so that felt the sort of right time. What I didn't want to do was be amongst it and just be water girl like that. I don't think that's enough respect for myself. So I did what I think was the right thing to do. But yeah, I would have loved another few caps along the way, and I always seem to be the one that got rotated and rested when we had the easy games, which was a bit annoying, but there we go.
I listened to an interview with Football Manager and former player Martin O'Neill a few weeks ago, and he was saying about how difficult it was being a player. I think he played in the 70s and 80s maybe before it became, and it was professional, but before it became a massive sport. Do you feel any kind of, maybe jealousy is too strong a word, but I wish I was professional 10 years after I was, and I wish I could have played in the kind of what feels like the first golden era of women's rugby now?
I'm not jealous. I just hope and I continue to get the rewards in terms of the commentating and being in and around it with the experience that I had, and being a trailblazer for the game. It's nice to get the recognition that we put women's rugby on the map. Yeah, it'd be lovely to get some of the plaudits they're getting now and the exposure, but I think I've done really well to keep my profile up high and get myself across well. But it'd be nice for a little bit of extra help to get you right at the forefront in that, be a top commentator. But you've got to work hard like anything. I wanted to be the best rugby player as long as I could, and now I want to be the best commentator I can be. So I'm still working really hard towards that, and fingers crossed we'll get there one day. But you can't give up because it hasn't happened for you for 6 months, a year, that kind of thing. But would I pick now or then? I'd pick then, because what I did for the game is really important for me in here. It wasn't about the money. I mean, 137 caps being paid, I'd have a really nice house now if I got that, but hey ho, I paved the way for the game, and I'm really proud of that. And winning the World Cup for me then was the icing on the cake.
How have you found the shift away from playing to commentating? And I know you did some coaching as well. How has that transition been? It seems fairly difficult for a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of people, it's really hard to go and watch a women's game without working at it, because I've still got some friends that are playing currently still, and that's hard. I think when it's another 5 years and they've all sort of gone, and that it's just there. I'm there as a fan, not a friend fan, and it's hard because it's still so raw. Because I had those couple of years, I retired 2018, but a couple of those years were sort of taken up by COVID, so nobody was playing, so I didn't miss
Yeah.
it too much then, and I was playing for Saracen, so I was still playing high level and getting that bit, but it's so hard, and there wasn't really a huge amount of support. And as I said before, I've had a few mental health struggles, and that particularly after I retired, 2019, 2020 was probably the lowest point. But now I'm in a really privileged position to be able to talk about it, educate others, and help support the next generations come through and pave the way for the future to get that help.
What would you say was the main cause of that? I think you sometimes see players feeling like they had a purpose, for want of a better word, and then when they retire, that at least that purpose goes for a few years until they find something different.
You've hit the nail on the head. Lack of purpose. Who am I? What am I doing? What's my role in life? Like, I was a rugby player, I was a role model, and now I'm a nobody, and I struggle with being a nobody, in my eyes. But you speak to a counsellor, and there's a really good point where they say, "What? So when you have, I know it's a bit dark, when you have your funeral, what do you want people to say about you? You're a brilliant rugby player, or that you're a really kind, lovely, welcoming, infectious person?" And I'm like, "Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. I want people to think of me as, infectious and being there and being a big personality." So that's, I guess, helped. But yeah, it is so hard. And any advice I can give to people, and go and find other things. Like, I've started doing upholstery and things like that. And some people are like, "Oh, you're so old." I'm like, I don't care. It's something different. I'm not getting my head kicked in every week, and I'm learning a new skill. And I don't have to be brilliant at it. I can be crap at it and keep going back and not embarrassed. So that is a key thing. I've taken up cycling, and I'm hiking up mountains and things for different challenges, just different charity events, and put myself through the ringer, and I get a massive buzz from that as well. So it's just finding what your next purpose is in life. Some people, it's having kids, but for me, that's not for me.
Yeah, you mentioned obviously you're still playing. That is quite unusual, I think, for someone to retire from a professional game but then take it up again at a lower level. Why did you want to keep going?
I still think, because I had a hamstring injury, I was out for over a year with that, towards the end of Saracens, and I thought, "Oh, I miss it. I really miss it. Shall I give it a go?" And I went, and I knew the coach because I coached with him, for Bucks County Women, and I thought, "I know some of these players. I'll give it a go. If I don't like it, or if I'm not very good, I'll stop." And then I found out I was still pretty good and could offer things. So again, it was actually, there's a purpose for me here, and I enjoy it, and it helps, get rid of some of those frustrations and being part of a team in the thick of it again. I love it. I love a hard game. I love a close game. I love the physicality of it. And when I can't do that, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll have to start find something.
It's interesting at the grassroots in the women's game, because I've been lucky enough to coach at Huddersfield Women for a few seasons, and a lot of our players had played no rugby until they came, and they might be 25 to 40 almost, who just haven't played rugby at all. Hopefully that's changing, but there's still not many schools that I don't think that are offering rugby to women. So I guess it poses an interesting situation, but potentially quite an exciting one, where you get these players who may be 25, maybe 30. They're really excited about the game. They've watched it on TV, and but they're starting from scratch, which you just don't get in the men's game. No one really comes at that age who hasn't played any rugby before. Maybe they only play at school, but that feels different in the women's game.
Yeah, and what I love about the women's game, they had these initiatives where they had these sort of taster sessions. I can't remember what it's called. It was like rock up and bring a mate kind of thing. And so they could try little mini touch games, hitting a tackle pad, that kind of thing. And you could see, even if you had 10 people, even if you only kept two that kept up, that's a big percentage. 20% stay. That's huge. And I love seeing any player I coach evolve. So whether it be an international like a Poppy Cleal who's done something amazing that you've helped coach them, or whether it's a brand new grassroots player who's 40 and picked up a rugby ball for the first time, seeing their face light up when they've done something really well, they scored a try, or they've got an offload, or they've put a big tackle in, that buzz I get from seeing their buzz is huge, and that is so warming as a coach. And that, you know, I still coach a private school 3 days a week, and then, you know, fill it up with my punditry and guest speaking and stuff off with the rest of the time. But it's so rewarding to see how those players develop from that and evolve. And it's a big buzz.
We're going to finish with a couple of quick fire questions. So, Lockie, what is the best game you personally have ever played?
I was playing for Henley, and we nearly folded because we were down to 13 players week in, week out, and we were getting our heads kicked in 80, 90 nil every week. People didn't want to play. Me, I'm different. I'll play if there's 11 of us. I'll play if I have to play prop, back row, 10, anything. And we had on the pitch, Nolly Waterman was playing as well. We had on the pitch six props, and I was playing number eight, and we beat Saracens 8-5. And, you know, to get one of our first wins, to beat massive Saracens, and I scored the try. It was incredible. You know, you had your back against the wall, you're playing the best of the best, you got six props who were pretty handy in the end. That was probably the highlight of my club career. And winning the Premiership with Worcester as well, lifting that. We were the only team outside of London at that point to win it. And then internationally, you can't beat winning the World Cup final and lifting that. So I'm sorry I gave you three answers.
Yeah, no, that's great.
They're all pretty important along my journey.
Who is the best player you've ever played with, either, I guess, with or against?
In terms of scrummaging, Sophie Hemming. We used to have some good old ding-dongs. She was my tight head, and we probably played 50-odd caps together. As well as we used to go against each other. And then a legend I loved playing with was Amy Garnett, 100 caps for England on the nose. She inspired me to keep, you know, to push myself, be the best. And how she switched from being like your best mate off the side of the pitch, and then she ripped your head off as soon as she stepped on it. I was like, how you do that is incredible. But yeah, a lot of respect for her. You wanted her on your team, not off your team. But and then Nolly Waterman, one of the most versatile, like the equivalent of Jason Robinson in the women's game. Her footwork, her physicality, her fend. She was bloody insane. Such a good girl and a great laugh. So, again, I'll give you three for the price of one.
That's perfect. Who is the best player you've played with who was not capped or not internationally capped?
Ooh, okay. Not internationally capped. For nobody. Like, not for...
Yeah, for no... Yeah.
Okay. I mean, Mae Campbell, is she capped now? Has she got one or not? I know she didn't for ages. I can't remember if she's got one. So Mae Campbell at Saracens, hooker slash flanker, scores a million tries every season. Really good little player. Who else? That's a tough one because a lot of them got capped. I'll have to get back to you on that one. I can't.
Yeah, yeah. What is the best stadium you've ever played in?
I can't go wrong, can I? Twickenham, pretty special. I mean, I would have loved to have played when it was filled to the rafters.
Yeah.
But you know, home of rugby was epic. And I've also played sevens, believe it or not, in front of 50,000 in Dubai. That was pretty epic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, I came on for the last couple of minutes, turned over a scrum and tried to not get gassed, but it was a pretty special moment.
And of the, I guess, either the things that are coming up in the women's game or hopefully will come up, Lions or European Cup, which would you have most liked to have been involved in?
And lions, definitely. I'm really sad there wasn't lions during us, but you know, never know. Hopefully, I'll go out there and be a commentator or something, or maybe help out, you know, with water bottles or something.
Lucky, I really, really appreciate it. It's been so good to have you on. Thank you for joining us for the 2 episodes. And yeah, best of luck with your burgeoning commentating career and with your continued exploits on the pitch as well.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to chat to you.